See all you loving Baba lovers here, some new faces and some familiar faces. I've been asked to give this talk again. I gave it last year and I probably won't, you know, I will repeat myself. I hope you'll forgive me. The title of the talk is The Difference Between Psychic and Spiritual Experiences, which seems to be a question that comes up these days because so many people have had one or the other, or are beginning to have one or the other, and want to know where it's at, so to speak. I'm sure most of you here have read the discourses that Baba has given on the place of occultism in the spiritual path, and that's another word. We have the use of the word psychic, mystic, occult, and without, you know, getting into too much of a bore of semantics, it is good to distinguish between these meanings for these three terms, as Baba does, because other groups use them in other ways. In fact, you see so many things called psychic that are not psychic, and things called mystical and are not mystical, and so on. The basic difference is that a psychic experience is different from a mystical experience in this way, that the person who's psychic is really basically using, as Baba says, the gross body to see and hear and feel and experience the semi-subtle world. That is, if you know your Baba charts, we're here now in the gross world. There's another world just beyond called the semi-subtle. And this semi-subtle world is not the world of the real subtle plane where the spiritual path begins. On the first plane, the second and the third are in that subtle world. It's an in-between world. Some groups call it the astral world, and other groups call it the etheric realm, and so forth. And the psychic person is using the gross body to experience that semi-subtle world. The person who has a genuine mystical experience, and I don't mean just a sort of a euphoria that you might get, or a feeling of, you know, a temporary oneness or upliftment and so forth. But a genuine mystical experience would be an opening, an experience on one of the planes, whichever one that you might experience. And that would be either in the subtle or the mental world. And the basic difference of a mystical experience is it's spiritual and religious meaning, whereas a psychic could have all sorts of experiences and they have nothing to do with the spiritual path at all. And this is the big question for a lot of people. I'll just give a small example. Supposing you have an experience of lights and colors and things that seem to be completely different from what you're experiencing with your gross eyes. You could experience that in the semi-subtle, the astral plane. Some of you have been on drugs. Some of you are still on drugs. I'm sorry, you could see it in your aura. You experience lights and colors and so on, but they are not the lights and colors, for example, of the first spiritual plane. There's a vast difference. As Baba said to us in 62, the spiritual path is a journey through inner space, and it is a journey. If you think that your gross body is here in the gross world, and if you're on the first plane, your consciousness would be like 100 million light years away. You'd be really experiencing Arcturus, I mean, just using it as a metaphor, while your gross body is here. It's that vast a jump in consciousness, even to the first plane. And so it's a very distinct difference from an experience of the astral or the semi-subtle. Now, this semi-subtle is the same place you'll go when you drop the body, most of us who are not on a spiritual plane. And the Baba says there are, you know, seven stages of this semi-subtle plane. Every plane is divided, including the spiritual planes, into sevens. There's seven stages on each of the planes. So seven times seven of the seven spiritual planes is 49. And this in classic mysticism are the 49 steps. Some of you have read St. John of the Cross. He divides the spiritual path into this 49 steps. And other groups have done the same, the Jewish Kabbalah and so on. And most of you who've read God Speaks know how interesting it is, these numbers, 7 and 5 and 12 and so on. Somebody asked me, why are these numbers there? And I said, well, look, when you studied chemistry, you had the periodic table of chemicals and all. It's just these odd figures in the universe. They're just the way it is. Why are there only, I forget now, X number on the sixth plane of advanced souls? And there's always that same number. If one becomes realized, then another one steps in. It's just the numerical setup of the universe. But to go back to the difference between the psychic and the mystical experience, it takes a lot of experiencing to even know where you are among psychic experiences. And because you, that semi-subtle world is also a vast world. It's divided into these seven different sections. The lowest section just is the closest to us. And as you know, it's sort of the idea of vibration. Everything is vibration. And the gross plane has its whole electromagnetic scale of vibrations. And at the top peak of that scale, then you step into the semi-subtle vibration. You're in it all the time, actually, but you're not aware of it. But in this new age, a lot of people are becoming psychic. It's just part of the new age. It's also part of the relaxing of the mental attitudes of the world. The scientific world was so down on all this stuff that it just wasn't recognized and acknowledged, but now it is, and so a lot of people are into it more, realizing they've had these experiences, always did have them, really, but because it's more open, even science is investigating this type of thing, there seems to be more happening. Actually, there was always people having all these different experiences. If you start researching it, there's just a vast amount, even of literature on this type of thing. But basically, the psychic is using the gross to touch the semi-subtle. And the basic way it's done, whether you do it unconsciously or you can study or train to do it, is to just disconnect from the brain, the physical brain. You know, you interpenetrate your brain with your subtle and mental body, and you just disconnect that a little bit. Now, this happens sometimes spontaneously when you drink alcohol, or you take drugs or medicines, or you're in a state of emotional something or other. Your brain and your subtle disconnect just enough. It's like a disconnected telephone. You know, if you think of the telephone just off the hook, you get a buzz, you know. and so you get these little flashes and stuff. Now, if you concentrate particularly in one direction, then you get a so-called psychic sense, like clairaudience. Clairaudience means you hear the semi-subtle. Clairvoyance, you see, and you smell, this and that. All these five senses can be used on the semi-subtle. Also in dreams, you contact the semi-subtle. There are different kinds of dreams. Bob has gone through that. And sometimes you actually, your whole subtle body, of course with your mental body, jump out of the physical and you do this so-called astral projection. You know, sometimes it happens spontaneously. For example, many, many stories and more are coming to light simply as, again, because medicine and science have recognized that people on operating tables or under anesthetic have really more or less astral projected. They've watched the operation, and they come back and they tell, oh, you said such and such, or why did you cut this way and not that way, you know. There's really a lot of interesting stories. It's a spontaneous disconnect between the subtle and the gross there. But the person who experiences the subtle plane, the first, second, and third, is consciously aware of that plane with his subtle body, using the subtle senses. See, the psychic is using the gross senses, and the mystic or illumined person on the first plane is consciously aware of the subtle plane, not the semi-subtle, and using his subtle senses. So he gets a totally different view of the whole world. And of course, Baba goes on and says that anybody on the planes is no longer focused on the gross. He's really not that aware of the gross. He's aware of the plane he's on. Now, that always puzzled me and many other people. But I suddenly thought of how it really works the other day. For example, I was reading somewhere about how your whole body functions, and you're not conscious of what your kidney's doing now, and your stomach is digesting, and your heart's beating. All that works a fantastic, complicated system, and you're not conscious of it. Your consciousness is in your head and your thoughts and all. And it's the same way with the saint on the plane. His mind is up there on the plane, and his his intellect and his gross body are functioning just automatically. To us, they seem like a normal person, but their consciousness, the flashlight of their consciousness is focused on that plane. The difference, Baba says, and all the classic writers like Evelyn Underhill on mysticism, the difference between a mystic experience you can judge is the feeling quality. And the feeling quality is of love, of bliss, the spiritual enlightenment that you really experience directly rather than a mental idea, distinguishes a mystical experience from a psychic or occult experience. And perhaps this is pretty difficult unless you've had both to judge, because some people, for example, even on drugs, you get a flash of oneness and stuff. It's not the experience, the true mystical experience on the planes, and it's only a matter of perhaps experiencing both to know the vast, vast difference. Although one can kind of give you a glimmer, a shadow experience. And the same thing with many of these books that are written from the other side through channeling and mediums and stuff like that. And I've met lately through my work with the ICC and other, a lot of people who channel. That brings up an interesting question. I don't really tackle them directly on the channeling, but they always channel this and that, and some of them think they're channeling masters and stuff. And for the record, you might say that, as Baba says, that no one on the planes, this means the first to the sixth, or of course God realized, because their consciousness is focused on that plane, as we said, comes back or would manifest on the semi-subtle or the gross. They do not channel. So whatever the person is channeling, usually he's either channeling to his higher inner self, which is perfectly legitimate, and he may call it Mr. X from planet Y, you know. We go through that a lot. And whatever the popular character is in mythology, maybe now it's a spaceman, in the Middle Ages it would have been an angel. As Jung points out very well in his book on flying saucers, he said, the myth of your culture is what defines these appearances of your archetype wisdom self. In the Middle Ages, an angel came to you and gave you directions, or maybe a devil. But now you see, that's all been put down for centuries, science, no angels, no devil. But who now? It's a spaceman, right? He's a scientific, more advanced soul. Actually, nobody's more advanced than the people on our own planet. It's always amusing to me that people go into this flying saucer stuff, and we have all the saints and masters and advanced souls on this planet, because Baba said this is where you have to come to go on the spiritual path. You will not find a six-plane must on you know, Arcturus or something. And of course, Baba didn't explain that the distances are too great. There is life out there in the universe, but there's no contact because the distances are so great. So that puts down all the space people and the space contacts and everything, space channeling and all that, which is very, very rife. But you see, what's really happening out there is people are developing their own inner awareness so much more, and they have to, they can't kind of accept that it's just their higher self awakening. They have to call it, you know, a figure, a myth figure, an archetype. And so these channelers do that. Occasionally they may channel from someone actually on the other side, and that's quite possible. And since the semi-subtle, which is where the contact might come from, is divided into seven levels, they're really very fine souls up there and wonderful people, but they're not on the planes. They're not advanced souls. So more about psychic experiences, I'm sure. How many here, let's just have a raised hand. How many think they've had a psychic experience? You see? That's terrific. And even in, it's sort of mankind going around in circles, because in primitive life, and it's true still now with people in the Australian bush and Africa and places like that where they don't have communication like we do, they have developed the ability to mental telepathy other people, you know, in these vast wildernesses. They might have to very much know right away something like where water is or where this is or where that is. And they develop the psychic ability as a survival technique, just as they have fantastic ability to smell, like some of the natives can track, like animals can, you know, a trail and all that. Man has an infinite capacity to develop one particular part of his nature. And the question comes up, should you develop psychic ability? Now, this is where Baba differs from probably everybody else, but he says no. In other words, to train your ability or learn to do these things, if they happen spontaneously, which happened to me, simply because in past lives you've done it or developed it, then what do you do with it? Because there it is, it's happening. Or you may spontaneously, like I call it sort of a psychic puberty, you know, you go through, suddenly, wow, it all hits you, you know, you're hearing this and you're seeing that. And the point is, why does Baba say no? And the reason is very, very simple. If you think about what the spiritual path really is, it's getting rid of the ego. That's it, in a nutshell, getting rid of the ego. It's not that these abilities aren't real, and not that they're not useful to some people sometimes. It's simply that your ego gets involved with them. And I can tell as myself, my own experiences, and many people I know who have been psychic, who are going through these things. It becomes, you see, you're one man up against the next person. You can hear something or see something or so on, then the other fellow can't. And the masters really clamp down on it a lot, because it would be pretty tough to have people, let's say, if I could read the stock market quotes of tomorrow's newspaper, I'd be one ahead of all of you, right? I would make a lot of money. I actually went through a little story, I know some of you know, that at Mattel, I sat next to a boy who used to go out at the Hollywood Park racetrack every day. So one day he said, "Oh, Phyllis, you're psychic, you know, here's the tote sheet, pick a winner, you know." So I looked down, and it said, there was one horse called Extrasensory Perception. And I thought, oh, that's got to be it, you know. And so he put his money on it, and it came in, paid 20 to 1 or something. So the next day, oh, wow, pick another one. And I was just having fun. They said, this one, this one, this one. They all won. And the news got around Mattel, and you know, it went on for a week. I was picking the Daily Double, and people were calling up their wives and saying, take $50 out of the bank. And then someone had bet on the horse I'd said, and it came in second instead of first, and he'd lost some money, and I was alone with him in the elevator, and he said, you didn't give, I lost $40. And I said, my God, Baba, what have I gotten into? And so it suddenly, you know, hit me, well, wow, I didn't mean to, but I really got into something. So, you know, it's just not right to fool around with these things. I'll tell you about my first awakening to the fact that I was psychic, because I think it was kind of interesting. I was only about 15, and I was down in Florida with my mother, and just for amusement, we'd gone to one of these message readers. We didn't even know what that was, but it's a common thing. The medium gets up, you write your message in a sealed envelope, and they just hold the envelope and give the message from the other side. And I had asked about the dead mother of a friend of mine. Yes, she spoke, gave me a little message. And the medium also included a boy that had died who I never met, but was a boyfriend of my roommate. Now this was in Florida. How she'd ever known this guy, you know, had died in a motorcycle accident, gave his name and everything. So I thought that was pretty fantastic, but, you know, it didn't interest me that much. So I go home and go to sleep, and then about 3 a.m, I wake up, and the room was filled with spirits. And they're all trying to get me, to knock me out of my body, you know, into a trance state. You're really knocked out. You're completely disconnected from your brain. And it was just horrifying, you know. And I instinctively fought them off, and I said, no, my body is mine. It's God's temple, you have no right to use it, and blah, blah, blah. And my mother woke up and said, what's the matter, Phyllis? You know? I said, I have indigestion. But you see, what had happened was that I'd been in this room where all the spirits were with a medium, and they can tell from your aura. You have a certain shade of color in your aura that shows that you're psychic. It's sort of an orchid color shade. And to them, it's like an open telephone. Wow, let's get a message from, you know. So they follow you around. They tried to get me. And so that was my first thing. And, you know, through the years in my teens, I had all sorts of weird experiences. I could read people's thoughts. I could look through walls, you know. Like, we lived on 11th Street in New York, and the wall would just dissolve, and I saw this guy in the next room. He's lying in his bed drinking beer, you know. Oh, God, I don't want this, you know. I'd meet him in the elevator, and I'd feel so embarrassed. You know? I'd tell you, really. And I could tell what was going to happen in the future, and that's really a heavy trip because you see these heavy things coming down. I wasn't really happy with it. And then during the war, I was sort of spontaneously, and I'm sure I'm sort of being asked to help on the battlefield. I've told this before, but it's quite interesting. Other people at that time. There were so many people dying in these radical, drastic things of the war, and they are in a state of shock. They don't know they're dead. They don't know what to do and everything. So you have to help them. You're just like a doctor on the other side, as they would be on this side. And it's all done mentally. You have to project calming thoughts and take them away from the battlefield because they'll stick by the body. Someone who doesn't know that, you know, and this is really a sad thing in our culture, they don't know how to die. You know, you don't know what happens to you or how to move away. So your locomotion, is that the right word? It's different on the other side. You have to think where you want to be. You don't have cars, trains, trucks, feet, you know. You have to project the thought of where you want to go. And so someone who doesn't know this, they are stuck with their dead body, and they can't move away. And, of course, on a battlefield, this is pretty bad. And so that was one thing. But I'd come back into my body, and, you know, like that, you get kind of a funny buzz. And my health was suffering with all this psychic stuff. But anyway, the upshot is that finally, you know, I met a man who knew more about all these things, and he helped me. The first day I met him, he looked in my eyes and said, you're running around too much on the astral plane. And I said, yeah, I guess so. So he helped me. And then, of course, Baba took away a lot of this stuff, because it really, to get back to the reason why it's bad, is your ego gets attached to it. And if you're into giving readings for other people or channeling and all that stuff, you get a big, big ego trip. And it's one of the worst ones. Baba says, definitely don't go to psychics. Don't go to fortune tellers. I've given up palmistry, in case anybody wants your palm ring. And, you know, it just gets to be your ego, and it's very flattering, you know, to have a little one-upmanship over others, and it's very dangerous. And also unnecessary. It's like Ramakrishna said, you get these cities, these powers, as you advance, but the masters take them away from you, you know, or use them at their discretion. Now, about the mystical experiences or occult experiences, Bob explained it in the discourses. He does, a master will give you experiences, very beautiful types of mystical experiences to encourage you. Like St. John of the Cross calls them the sweets. And it's like Bob says to a child that needs to learn the alphabet, if you make the letters out of sugar, you know, you're going to learn them a little better. And so Baba and other masters do the same thing. They give you a little glimpse. Now, that doesn't mean that you're on that plane. This is something else one has to think. You may have a very beautiful experience through Baba's grace, or other masters too. A spiritual experience, a genuine opening. But that's their grace. It does not mean that you've been lifted up to that plane or you are on that plane. And I think this is important, because some people get really, I don't know how many people I've met in the last few years that go around saying, I'm on the first plane, I'm on the sixth plane. You know, they've had something, and it is very overwhelming, fantastic, but it does not mean necessarily that you are advanced to that plane. The masters give you that to encourage you, like a sweetmeat. And if you get too attached to it, you know, they take it away real fast. And no matter how you blab and bleat about it, you know, it's something you can't fake. Yeah.
Oh, can you tell us a little about the time, about back when you were friends with Narina and Nadine and I guess Jane Adriel, because I guess they had similar experiences.
Yes, Baba's disciples, especially Narina and Jane Adriel, were types that probably through past lives had a lot of a psychic development. I know Narina told me how, this is before she heard of Baba, she got into a place where she was almost a Uri Geller. Everything would fly around in the room and all sorts of, you know, the energy patterns were, you know, the manifest. I'm not going into all the types of psychic experiences, but one of them is manipulating the energy field around you. It's just poltergeist phenomena, Uri Geller, although he's a fake. He buys his equipment from magicians, by the way, because I have magician friends. You know, that type of thing. And so she didn't know what to do, but she met a very wonderful soul named Claude Bragdon, who's written some wonderful books, and he helped her get rid of that. And then, of course, when she met Baba, Baba took away a lot of that. And Jean Adriel also had some of these psychic things that debilitated her health. And she also, both Narina and Jean have written up their mystical experiences. And these are different from just the psychic phenomena. But Narina still, Baba doesn't take away, it doesn't take it away, kind of cools it, that's the right word to say. As Narina was pretty psychic. I'll tell you a funny little story about during the war, the British intelligence were very actively watching everything Hindus did. And this is one reason Baba said no politics at all. And because of the freeing of India, you know, the British. So they had, you know, intelligence was watching our Baba group, and it was a woman, an FBI, working with a British intelligence chair. She used to come to our meetings, a rather nondescript middle-aged lady. So one day, Narina called her over and said, I know you're working for the FBI. And she just, you know, wow. And Narina said, I also know you're an alcoholic. And that really blew her mind. And from then on, she would tell us, you know, she became a devil agent. In other words. And the FBI does have a very complete file on Mayor Baba, by the way. And some of these anguished parents, you know, have reported us to the FBI. But they always say, oh, sure, we know Mayor Baba. Good guy. And so it came in handy. And again, I'll have to, I know you like to hear these little stories, but the reason that I became so psychic was in past lives. I've been actually trained as a psychic. I was in Egypt, one of these girls, young girls, they train in the temples to concentrate under hypnosis and read what was happening, you know, because they would say, well, are we be invading, are the Hittites coming, you know. You could see far away and find out what was happening. Don't forget, they didn't have wireless and they didn't have this and that. They used these abilities and they trained you in the temple for that work. And then in Greece, I was one of those priestesses or whatever they call them now, pythonesses or something, who would sit over this crack. They put you on this high stool and sit over the crack where the nitrous oxide gas would go. And this trips you out of your brain cells, you know, a little. And you mumble something, and then that's the prophecy of the Delphic Oracle. And I remember how freaked out I was when I went to the Metropolitan in the Greek room there. They had this high iron three-legged stool. And that was what it was. It's a stool from them. So, I tell you, that gas made you sick, too. And other similar lives. So I've had enough of it, and I don't want any more of it. And again, it's an ego trip. Baba wrote a very interesting letter to the Luck brothers and also someone else about never going to psychics. So I know some of you do go get your fortune told, but the reason is the psychic, you're creating karma, and the better the psychic is, the worse it is, because the more you believe the person, you see. Their percent of accuracy is very low, really, when you get down to it, because we have so-called free will. I know Baba says we don't have free will, but you know, on the relative plane, we have free will. They cannot do any more than a good computer can do. Say the probabilities are such and such, because anyone can exercise their free will and change their decisions. So the combined decisions of people there can change what the action will be in the future. So they cannot predict. Only Baba can do that, or a perfect one, because not only do they know what will happen, but they make it happen. They decide what will happen in that sense. And so that's one reason psychics are bad. They do not predict accurately. If they predict with a certain amount of accuracy, you believe in them, and they start programming your head. And you, because you say such and such will happen, you're already orienting your psyche to it. You can program your own self. And this is a very fine technique, and more people are getting into it, to program, you know, write your own script, kind of thing, consciously, instead of following your unconscious script. That's what the humanistic psychology is doing, so that you don't repeat your sanskaric patterns, you kind of realize that you can change that script. You don't always have to fall in love with the alcoholic and marry him, you know, and divorce him and marry another alcoholic, you know, and stuff. Writing your own script, if you have a problem in life and you're doing it over and over again, you're writing your own script, but that's another side issue of psychology.
Is that like the Unity Church's technique?
Yes, basically they're all kind of into the same idea. That's kind of digressing to get into, you know, some of this positive thinking, where Baba tells you it's a little bit different. It's not, you can program the positive action, but you must recognize Maya is positive and negative, and Baba gives you the balance to accept the negative, which I find people who just have programmed positive, 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 they cannot face the negative in themselves. They just refuse to see it because they've been trained not to see it. And it's very difficult to critique a person like that or to get them to accept failure as their own responsibility. It's always somebody else that's wrong, you know. That's what, you know, if you learn to accept the negative in yourself and others, Maya, you know, it's better. It's a better balance. And some of these positive thinking types of religious, I hope there are no religious scientists in here, but they accentuate that. But they gained it basically from the Eastern thought, where you do learn to control your mind and the patterns of the mind, and to program your life on a better, more positive way. Certainly you want to program the positive and not the negative, but the negative will happen. Nobody in the world. And with Baba, maybe a little more. And that's another whole question, how Baba speeds up your karma. I'll have to share a little whatever mystical vision or something. When I was in India and I busted this foot, you know, and I was lying on my bed there in that little Velu villa, I do get these experiences with Baba, but he walked in as the Buddha, not as Baba. And he held in his hand, very casually, you know, the wheel of the law, and it was like a million knives of diamond knives whirling at top speed, you know, and you look at that, it's like a symbol, but it just, it's like Baba saying, Buddha saying, it's karma, it had to happen. And when you know, that was my foot, and he gave me a glimpse of why the karma, but it just has to happen, the negative has to come out, you have to balance your karma that way. And that's why I love Buddhism, really, basically, because it just lays it out as it is, the karma, the maya, the positive and the negative, and the action and reaction of the law. And that's another reason not to get into psychic things, because your karma gets involved with other people. The psychic gets all the karma that he's programming other people into. See, he's taking the responsibility, and they have no training, none of them. I've never met one. They say they do, but they don't really, because they don't have a master, first of all. They have no judgment in what they say to people, you know, from a spiritual point of view. And I know I've had to unprogram some people recently, been to psychics who told them, you know, dreadful things that were going to happen, and it just spooked them out. And, you know, it's really a bad thing, a responsibility to tell anyone things like that, even if it's true. And that's where they get into the wrong use of psychic abilities. Fortunately, as Baba said, the masters do hide the real occult power, like where you can manipulate, basically you manipulate the ether, whatever you want to call it, and you can manifest this, that, and the other, because that would be, Baba and the masters want you to solve your gross world problems on the gross level. That is, if you need money, then you get out there and you move your butt and you earn it. You don't manifest dollars under the table. Although I heard, and this is probably pretty true, that Father Divine, who was a black man, who was one of these false avatars, you know, everybody thought he was God, and he had this fantastic group in the 30s and 40s. He must have had some ability because they said just take the dollar bill and go like this. There were X number of bills, you know.
Like Reverend Ike.
I don't know, Reverend Ike. There must be a new one. There's a new one every day. they do control that type of thing. I'll tell you a little story about things like that. I was sitting with Baba in Scarsdale, 52, and this wonderful old lady, Ruana Bogoslav, who'd been with Baba many years, she looked at Baba kind of longingly, and, you know, she said, "Baba, is this the last time I'm going to see you?" And it turned out to be true. And then she started telling him how when she was called to India to join the Nazik ashram, she had no money. And so she went to, with a friend, went along to see a psychic. And the psychic said, "Well, if you take off that bracelet," she was wearing an old antique Chinese bracelet, "everything will get better for you." So she came back. She thought, "Well, what have I got to lose? I'll take off the bracelet." And she, you know, within a few days, somebody sent her a check for $500. And so she got to India. So she said to Bob, "Is it true, you know, that a bracelet or something could do that, that would hold the karma from other?" Oh, the lady had said this bracelet had belonged to someone in China who had lost all possessions and had, you know, bad material luck. And Baba nodded his head and he said, "Well, not too much should be known about it because it creates superstition, but it is true that certain metals and substances like black wool, certain gems, and animals like dogs and cats hold the sanskaras," that was his expression, "because they're at the turns of evolution." You know Baba's chart, the five turns, certain things, sort of like I imagined when I was listening to it, that they had extra twists, that they could hold the sanskaras. And that's the reason, you know, certain gems have had actual bad luck for people and good luck, talismans. And the Sufis wear the black robe, the Suf, it's one reason they supposedly call themselves Sufis, because black wool, Baba said that wool, holds sanskaras. And when the Sufi Murshid used to give his robe to the next one, actually he's transferring, you know, something in that robe. And it's interesting because Baba said his Kamali coat, which again was what I was trying to touch when I fell. Baba said of all his belongings or something, that would do the most spiritual work in the future. And some words to that effect. He said, "You don't know what that jacket will do in the future."
And,
broke my foot. Well, I consider that grace, you see, grace, because what Baba does basically is he speeds up your karma, he gives you the karma, but he ameliorates it. I could have had a terrible accident, but instead I got a little bone damage, you know. That's the way I feel about it. And it was my karma, you know. Also, interesting story. Just before I went on my trip, I took out of my belongings some sneakers I had in 52, because I had the same size foot Baba did. I knew what size to get. I bought him a pair of sneakers. I thought he might, you know, I don't know. You know. I had bought him a pair of sandals so that I could touch his feet putting them on. And that had worked very well in Myrtle Beach. Because Baba was in the New Life and we weren't allowed to bow down and touch his feet. So I thought, so I bought a pair of sandals and Baba let me put it on. So I was, you know. And then I thought, "Oh, this is groovy. I'll get him a pair of sneakers." And so I got the sneakers, and this is when he was in the cast, you know, and he put his right foot in the right sneaker. And he smiled, and he shook his head and said, "No, you wear them." And so I took the sneakers. I've kept them all these years. And so before the trip, I thought, "Well, I need a little good luck. I'll put my right foot in that right sneaker." You got the karma on my foot.
Saved you from a worse
probably saved me from God knows what. I mean, I could have busted my neck on that stone floor. So, anyway, where was I? That was an awful experience.
Philip,
yeah.
Oh, what puzzled me is, like, why does, like, Moshe Navi do use psychics and stuff like that?
Well, you know, as I said last summer in the same talk, I have nothing to say about what Moshe does. Bob has given her, you know, his grace to do what she thinks is best, you know. And I know I've had little discussions with her about it. She feels that Merle uses her just to help a few people whose karma, they, you know, would be better for them to know why certain things are happening. That brings up another question about past life memories. This is a very interesting phenomenon, and it's happening again more and more to people because I think they're open mentally to it, some of their experiences as a memory. And little children, you know, Baba says up to the age of 7 years, they are open to the semi-subtle. They can experience that. That's why they see fairies and nature spirits, and they have little playmates from the other side, you know. The psychologist says, oh yeah, imaginary playmates. But I think the kids know better than that. And I remember, I think it was Frank Eaton's little boy. It was born in 1947 or something like that. As soon as he could talk, he said, oh, my plane is burning. The plane is falling. You know, he kept saying that for days and days. And it got over. Obviously a reincarnation of some pilot in World War II. You know, and I know other people have had memories of World War II. A lot of you are young enough that you could have been in that war. Baba said about the people who died in that war, boys that on both sides, that through his grace they would reincarnate very rapidly. And that brings up another question, because the theosophists and people like that, you know, they say, oh, it was 1,000 years between one birth and another, and I'm never going to live, you know, come back to this place. It's grace to reincarnate. It's grace to go through the whole rat race again, more and more. And Baba will spin you faster and faster through the reincarnation. What is that song? Evolution, revolution. And so a lot of people are born. I think that's one reason there was such so many kids refused to fight in Vietnam. After all, 20 years ago, they bombed out on the Battle of the Bulge or something. You're not really going to be shot again. And a lot of them were reincarnated, you know, very fast, and the same sex of men. I'm so glad I was a woman. So. And although in past lives I did my share of soldiering and chopping people's heads off. So reincarnation memories are a fact, and they're not that hard to find. And it's again a question of disconnecting your brain a little. You have a tape recorder working, a divine tape recorder. The etheric realm, or the whatever the substance is, I call it ether just because everybody else does, but it records everything, absolutely letter perfect. You know, color audio or visual audio, color TV. And if you press the right little button, you know, in your brain, now you can recall it like out here, and you're watching it like a little scene, or you can get really into it and kind of relive it completely, which people do under hypnosis. And a lot of people experiment with that. It's all there, your whole record of everything. And it is kind of interesting to know, as Baba says, as you advance, you will reach a place where these memories are very easy to recall, because by that time you're able to handle it. But if you recall them too much, too soon, you'll have a split personality. And actually, I think some cases, medically, of split personality are people who have not integrated their they haven't shut the door off on past lives, and they're still reliving, you know, another personality. Because you, the strange thing is, though, your identity, you get a very interesting idea of what identity is. It's not what you ordinarily think of as your personality, what other people react to as your personality. Your personality is, of course, here again you have Buddhism, is a cluster of sanskaras that you picked for that incarnation. You have thousands of sanskaras, but you put together kind of a bundle, and that's your personality for that life. But in another life, you could pick a different bundle, and you could have a different personality, although your identity is one. You're like beads on a string, but the beads can be very different, and this is kind of a shock when you go back and you remember you were a lousy, nasty guy, you know, you're a sweet, innocent girl in this life, you know, a big shock, or whatever, you know, whatever you were, and not too far back, you know, and it's just that, and the reason why you have to work out these different bundles of sanskaras in yourself, they have to be worked out in a life. And here again, Baba and the Easterners differ from all the Catholic and Jewish and every the Semitic, basic Judaic religions, and saying you do reincarnate and you do have to work out in this life your karma. You don't work it out in some future world. You can go through experiences on the semi-subtle when you drop the body, but you basically, karma has to be worked out here, and that's why you have to have a body. You can't even be God realized on the other side. You realize here. Baba makes that very clear. And that is why the Vedanta prayer is the three blessings of life. One, to have a physical body. Two, to have longing for the path, for God. And three, to have a master. These are the three. And we all in this room have all three, right? We've made it, folks. And believe me, it's not that easy when you think of the millions of souls on other planets waiting to be born here, millions of souls on the other side, many, many more than incarnate, and millions of souls in the body today who have just no idea of the whole thing. And other hundreds of souls who are following false mushroom gurus, Baba calls them. And poisonous mushrooms, right? And I just finished a book called The Spiritual Supermarket. I'll tell you, that scares the hell out of you, these guys are going around being gurus. So, any questions? Yeah.
If you haven't had any experience in the psychic realm, how would you attempt to even counsel somebody who came to you with questions about their own experience?
That's a good question. There are, I was even thinking of writing a book called How to Understand Your Psychic Experience, because so many books written today, I mean, you couldn't tell them yourself, but you could point them to Baba and what he said in the discourses. And in Murshida's book, she goes into a few points and other places in the Baba literature. But the general literature is exploiting psychic experiences outside in the literary market, so I don't know. You'd have to say that the basic thing I'm saying now is not to get into them or elaborate them, but to there are certain books to read that show what other people have done. It's not that far out of the ordinary. I think a lot of people are scared by their psychic experiences, thinking they're going crazy and stuff. Yeah.
Two questions. On reincarnation, you're talking about these many more souls that are not reincarnated.
Yeah. Well, Baba was talking mostly about these boys who sacrificed their life in the war. Because of their sacrifice of life, they would be given life again right away. And I also think that some of the people who met Baba in the early 20s and 30s dropped the body, and I think some of you even feel maybe you were one of those people who met Baba. You think you never met Baba, but how do you know you might have met Baba? Yeah. But the determining factor about when you reincarnate is your karma, basically. The sanskaric drives, and Baba gives probably the best, we know it's the best, excuse me, explanation of the drive of sanskaras. It's like a pendulum. It goes from one side to the other, from one opposite to the other, and Baba kind of brings that out so many times. He said, you've been rich and poor, and beautiful and ugly, and sick and well. In other words, if you've been sick in this life, you'll have a good chance probably, which is sort of hopeful, isn't it, to be nice and healthy in another one. And you've been stinking rich, well, then you may be one of those beggars in India next time. Or those beggars in India, you know. Been rich in Berkeley? Or a beggar in Berkeley? Okay. In other words, you don't avoid, people teach you through good actions you'll have good karma. But don't forget, good karma is also to experience the opposites. It can be good karma to be desperately poor because you learn the value of things in a totally different way. I remember, I don't know whether it was a Ruth Montgomery book or something, she describes a life way back in Palestine when she was just desperately poor with children to feed, and how she stole food, and how, you know, she had her other very glamorous lives, but this life taught her just how precious life can be. The edge between life and death can be just a crust of bread, and this is something you have to experience, and that's grace too. Yeah.
And I'm wondering if you can give me a little clarification on seeing Bob in his form and what kind of...
I certainly wouldn't pose as any authority. I have seen Baba. I did see Baba from the very beginning that way. When I first came to Narina's talks, you know, I really wasn't interested that much in the talk or anything. And I don't mean that way, but Baba was there. That was really, so often he would appear. And that was just a fantastic experience. Yeah.
Wasn't Darwin there?
And yeah, Darwin, yeah, thank you. One of the first times I came to their afternoon teas, and everyone was chatting about Baba, and they were all talking, you know, the old man really about Baba. And suddenly I saw Baba standing there in his subtle form. He always looks beautiful and young, by the way. And, you know, sort of go like that, and I thought, And then I look over at Darwin, and he was looking there too, and I looked in his eyes, you know, and we sort of knew, you know. I thought, well, I'm not that crazy, you know. Nobody else is saying that. And so Baba does manifest still, and it always did, and he says somewhere in the discourses, the master can manifest in many, many places at the same time. You know the story of Jesus. He was seen, well, how many times, you Bible students? How many times all at once?
Bill Rafe was seen like
all
Yes,
the that's right. It's death or something. Yeah. So it's like Baba's presence is everywhere, but he kind of crystallizes it at certain moments by appearing or letting you see him that way. But I found this, that when Baba appeared that way to my inner eye, so to speak, other people were feeling his presence, so I don't think of it as something special just to see the form. Because if you feel Baba's presence, and we've all had that moment, I'm sure, he's there. You know, and it's just like Mira said so delightfully when I was there, because I was always very shy about talking about these things, but somehow Mira released me from that, because one of the last days I was there this time, she said, well, Baba's always with us, but if you look just in the right corner at the right moment, you see him. And she said, he has been seen here at Mira's. He was seen on the hill, and the night watchman saw him in the garden late at night. And then she told, didn't mention my name, she said, he was seen in the tomb. I saw Baba in the tomb when I first came there. And so he's around. You know, he's with us. He's with you eternally, he said. I'm sure Bob will be seen. And people see him in his old form as Jesus or Buddha or whatever. Why not? Krishna. It's just now that he seems more vital, as Baba just said. The more recent incarnation as the avatar is more powerful, just like Baba's name. Baba is more powerful, but the name of Jesus is powerful. Millions of people. To Buddha is powerful, you know. His power is so great. His glory is so great.
Really?
Yeah.
Did Baba ever say anything about prayer to you? About prayer affecting other people?
Or praying for other people? Well, Baba basically says, take my name. Like one boy came in 52 to meet Baba, and I guess he, you know, programmed his head with all this stuff about mantras and stuff. So he asked Baba for a mantra. And Baba said, I don't give mantras, but you can take my name, you know. And basically that's all a mantra is, a divine word or name that you say. By saying it constantly, for example, the occultism of it is that you create a very powerful sound wave, and this breaks up the sound waves of your sanskaras. It's like a hammer, bang, 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 bang. And you don't have to think of the bad sanskara you're trying to break up, but just saying the mantra breaks it up anyway, and reprograms you.
That's what, when Joseph was in the hospital and I saw him a third time, I said, oh, when I go down, I'll tell everybody to, we'll all pray for you, chant.
Chant, yeah. We chanted in our little group in Manhattan Beach out loud for half an hour for different people. It was nice. All together you build up the vibration. You know, people are sort of against ceremony and rituals and prayers and stuff, but they don't realize the occultism behind it. For one reason or another, that is important to know, a little occultism, to know why through the ages certain things have been done. There is a law to the inner world of energy. And the fact, the basic law, I've tried to formulate it, other people try, is that a certain structure to the wave vibration draws the similar vibration out of the rest of nature, which you can understand if you've seen a tuning fork, you hit it to the tone A, another tuning fork will start vibrating to tune A. And that's the basic occult law, for example, of prayer. If you all concentrate, you're building up a very strong tone of a certain vibration, and it helps everybody. This is why group prayer is good. It's not because it's a ritual or, you know, all that stuff we don't like. It's just an occult fact that people together on the same wavelength are creating a basic pattern. It breaks up your negative sanskaras, and it creates, if you could see it from the other side in the ether, it's like a pool. You know how you throw a stone in a pool, the waves will go way out, you know. And you create a vibration in that place, and if you pray in the same place for a long time, and this is another reason for having a place to meditate, a time, same thing, and why you go in an old church, you feel the vibrations of centuries of prayer. You feel, you know, your mind is calmed down by the vibrations. The baraka, as the Sufis call it, is still there. The same place if you go in a lousy tavern, you know, the vibrations are still there. All the drunks and the bad stuff. And that brings it up for another little interesting thing. If you're psychic, you can see why you shouldn't drink, because it knocks the subtle body just out of the physical. In fact, it looks like, you know, if your stuffing's been pulled out, you see the gross form, and then you see the subtle just hanging out like this. And it's very, and you could see people on the other side trying to get into that opening that you've created. And the same with drugs. You blow a hole, so to speak, in your aura, and other vibrations, other entities, other discarnate people can then get in through that hole and make you do things or influence you. You pick up their bad vibes and stuff. very simple reason not to drink or take drugs. Yeah.
Would you say the same thing for psychoactive drugs that are used by psychiatrists for, you know, so-called medical?
You mean hallucinogens used by psychologists?
No, I'm thinking more of, for instance, use of tranquilizers to take the kindness.
Well, I couldn't say one particular drug. Bobby has warned us against hallucinogens, and I know they still use LSD, for example, in treating terminal cancer patients. But basically, any drug alters the brain structure, I mean the chemistry of the brain, and who knows, especially with these new modern synthesized drugs. I read something pretty horrendous in the newspapers the other day. They have an international agreement, I guess it's through the United Nations, I don't remember, not to experiment too far with creating life in test tubes. They have gone so far in these secret labs, and I know some people who work in these places, with creating chemical new formulas and new this and that, so that they can synthesize so that life forms. They're afraid, for example, that they'd create a new microbe that could not be controlled, that might wipe out humanity. And so they've had to sign an agreement among all the nations who do this secret biological chemistry and whatnot, that they're afraid of what they can do. And they probably reach the same thing with the drugs. They can now, I know one man told me he works in a government lab for this type of thing. They can create drugs and sound waves that can program a person to do anything they want. In other words, they activate the sanscaras a certain direction, and it's frightening because you can think about things like that in the hands of people who don't know what the hell they're doing, don't know anything about the real structure of man, you know, the bodies and the reincarnation and stuff. It's really, your generation is the one, first generation, that had to face these synthesized drugs and the problems they create. You know, God knows what they are creating. We just hope, you know, the masters know what they're doing. They have to let these things happen. They have to let man experiment, but, you know, let it get out of hand. The same thing with the atomic energy, you know. They will be doing more and more in the next 700 years. Baba did say that when he came again, science would be at the zenith of... don't forget, we've had science, so to speak, only for 100 years in all mankind's history. And look what it has brought us, and the problems, too. And just think another 700 years of it. It will just be unbelievable things. They will really begin to manipulate life, biologically, work on your sanskaras, your brain, and everything. They can already put things into the brain to program people from being less aggressive. You've read all those things. Really interesting. They must learn more about sanskaras and what they're really fooling with. And this is Baba's work through God Speaks and through his teachings. Just the intellectual background that these people ought to have before they go on and on with these things. Any other questions? Yeah.
How much importance should one attach to dreams?
Dreams. Well, Baba did describe 7 kinds of dreams. It's in the back of Listen Humanity and a few other places. Basically, I don't remember them all, actually, but basically you remember the past. You're dreaming of things that happened just recently, and you jumble them up and create a dream. You may see the future in a dream. You can work out sanskaras in a dream. You can actually experience the semi-subtle in a dream. That is, wander around in the semi-subtle. You can have a real mystical experience in a dream while you're out of the body, so to speak, drop the body. So they're very different kinds of dreams. And there's a very interesting book called Creative Dreaming, and it was written by a psychologist who studied this tribe whose whole culture is to study your dreams and to learn to analyze your dreams and use them. They start with children and teach them how to remember their dreams and work with them. And they work through a lot of sanskaras by studying their dreams. The child has to tell his dreams every morning, and the parents then go over it and say, no, this is that and this is that. So the next night they dream another dream. And they grow up very well adjusted. They've worked out a lot of sanskaras through programming their dreaming. And this is a definite technique too. which is sort of a little twist on having the psychoanalyst spend, you know, 10 years digging out your dreams. I think more people will learn more about dreaming and how it can be used helpfully. And you can learn to remember dreams, you can learn to analyze dreams, you know, there's a lot of work to be done, but it's a fascinating field. I was always very interested. Basically, to understand ordinary dream, you have to study dream symbology. You know, you have to begin there, because what the symbols in the dream mean to you and your memories and so forth, you know, how you understand it. Is it time for a break? Everybody want to get up?
No.
No.
One more.
No, okay. Go to the John and everything. Okay, yeah.
If we're moving into a more enlightened age where people are more interested in supernormal activity.
Yeah.
Would you say, like healing, for instance, are people taking it on other individuals?
Well, healing's an interesting question. Yeah. Shall I wait till everybody leaves?
Yeah. Whether or not it's legitimate to use psychic power, psychic perception for non-psychic purposes, such as diagnosing emotional disorders or physical disorders and things of that sort.
That's sort of the question that Clive over here asked. As more and more people are getting into what they call New Age healing, and there are people who do see auras, for example, and use it to, it's very easy from the aura, probably the best way to diagnose a medical condition, because it shows immediately, you know, where, you know, problems are coming from, and even if you're a good aura reader, why they're coming, you know, the emotional sanskara shows. And so I imagine that more and more people will use that. And there's things like color healing. Since the aura is basically a colorful thing, you know, Baba says we have 7 deep dark shades of sanskaras. Everybody has these 7 colors, and they break up into innumerable shades. And each shade is a sanskara. So you can look at somebody, you know, with a muddy green aura right at the moment, you know, they're feeling very jealous. Envy is a green. You even say green with envy. You know, some of our, you know, or a horrible, nasty red color, and they're angry. And some psychic said very amusingly, "Oh, I hate to drive on the freeway. I see all those angry red auras." So I think, you know, I think people will begin to use these things. But you see, they must make a distinction here from someone who's on the spiritual path and someone who isn't. I would say this, that mankind will advance to use some of the so-called psychic ability in a good way, like a doctor would use his instrument. Again, he'll fall into the trap of the ego. Whereas Baba, if we're following Baba, then we're not going to use that, I think, without a great deal of thought about what it means for ourselves and our ego. See, there are two different worlds there, the spiritual aspirant. And you must remember that when you read the discourses, this is for those who are trying to reach God the fastest, the best way. And the trap of healing, nobody would put down healing. I'm the first one that wants to be healed, right? But to use the psychic healing, the person who does that, you see, is taking on the karma. It's like the Swami in the... Whereas the doctor really isn't. He's using his gross plane instruments and his intellect, his you know, his training. Whereas the psychic, there are two types basically of healing, I would say. It's very complicated, but two basic types, maybe three. The first one is if a person is a good person with a good vibration and uplifted consciousness, a little training in psychology, he can help that person to help himself. This is sort of basically what faith healing is. I can get you so steamed up that you have tremendous faith, and that faith changes your karmic sanskara and you get well. The second kind is the yogi, who really has the siddhi, the power to heal. And he just simply takes that karma from you, just as if you owed 50 bucks and he gave you 50 bucks and your debt is clear. But he now owes the money. And that's what this old Swami, I remember so well, someone asked him that. And he says, where does the karma go? this person asked, what if you had cancer, you know, and wouldn't it be right to heal that person of cancer if you had the ability? And he said, yes, it can be done, but where would the karma go? That cancer was a death. It's an expression of karma. And if somebody comes and pays your debt, then they have that debt. So the healer piles up every debt that he's taken away from everybody else. Now he gets real steamed up on helping humanity, blah, blah, blah. But he's piling up his sanskaras as high as the moon. And he has to someday, in some other life, work out all that karma. He has to get cancer or he has to find a master who cancels his debt. It's very, very simple. And one time Baba suffered a great deal. It's in the old journal or something. Got these strange illnesses. And he said, I'm working out to his disciples, his Mandalay, your karma, your yogi karma. See, now they must have done similar things. They must have used their yogi power to do what? I don't know what. But Baba had to take that debt on himself and wipe it out. Otherwise they would have.
I already said you're the cancer of the world. You have no cancer, said to one of his disciples. I have the cancer.
Yes, well, of course, Baba had all of Bob explains, though, the difference that he didn't take on anyone's karma. Didn't take on, you know, there's a technical point there. Yeah.
Is there anything to the thought that if the yogi type karma is being removed from you, that your action becomes weak because you don't work it off yourself?
Well, it's true. You're not going to learn that lesson. That's why when Baba came in 52, he had to circulate a message about miracles and about healing. He said, premature healing can delay the real spiritual healing, you see. In other words, the lesson you learn through illness, you know, you may then develop spiritually because you're learning patience and, you know, all the things you go through when you're ill. And if somebody comes along and just wipes it out, where are you learning? It's nice, but you haven't learned. And so that's a thought, too, for spiritual healing. And, yeah.
Can you ask the question, when you dream, are you out of your body?
Are you out of the body when you dream? Well, that's why I said there are different types of dreams. Some dreams you wander around in the semi-subtle. And some, the basic type of dream, though, that most people have is, it's like a kaleidoscope. You have all these little bits of broken glass, all these little bits of your sanskaric impressions. And in the dream state, you jumble them around and you look through and you see something weird and new and you experience all these things. And it basically has some psychological pattern to it. That's the dream that we most have most. But you can dream to be out of the body. That's why I say you can astral project in the dream or you can mess around the semi-subtle. You might meet your, it happens to me, meet my dead mother and have a nice conversation with her on the semi-subtle. You know, in a dream state. And, you know, that type happens too. You know, just depends. They're all kinds, yeah.
You just brought it up. You meet someone. You met your mother on the But how about, okay, let's say you meet someone who's older. Let's say just that, for instance, that your mother's already taken at new birth, that soul who was your mother. Would you still be able to meet your mother?
No. In the semi-subtle, I'd say, my mother's still there. She's gone through some stages and she died in 71, but you know, occasionally we connect, you know, and talk and meet. But when she reincarnates, she'll be, see what happens when you reincarnate, the veil has come down, cuts off your memory of who you were, and you're born with this seal. It's like a seal on the lid of a jar, you know.
Like Marina.
Yeah, right. Narina's over there now. She's a 17-year-old boy now. She doesn't know anything about her life as Narina. Doesn't remember it. She's living her life as a little boy in India. You know, if she remembered herself as Princess Machiavelli, you know, what the heck? She'd have a terrible time. People tell her that, you know, tell him, her. Well, he doesn't like to hear about it.
Maybe you'd like to get his inheritance.
Yeah, I know. No, Princess Machiavelli gave everything to Baba. Yeah.
Baba talks about the heaven and hell states between incarnations.
Right.
Almost exclusively. And not about experiencing the semi-subtle.
Well, that's where the heaven and hell is.
But he talks about it as being subjective state.
That's right, it is subjective. The semi-subtle is when you don't have the gross body and you're in the so-called astral world. And the basic thing that happens to a person is all those sanskaras that you built up in this life, the impressions on your tape recorder, are there. And you kind of go through, depending on your state of advancement and how much help you have from others too, to review it all and experience it all. And if you did a lot of nasties, you're going to suffer for that through your own conscience, showing you what you've done, which you're maybe unaware of the effects of it all as you were here. But if you've been nice, you've been loving, and you've done this and that, everybody does a little of both, let's face it. So you experience a little heaven and a little hell, you know. And the Catholics threw purgatory in there. But that's because they didn't know really what to say. As far as I'm concerned, it's all purge. All purge. And you work out some of the, you reassemble your sanskaras for the next birth. It would be kind of senseless, and that's what happens sometimes when people plunge right back into the body. They haven't gone through this enough of this review state. And so they come back. For example, when somebody's executed in San Quentin, it's a stupid thing to do because that person dies with a vengeance and hate and fear and everything, and he might just be so eager to get a body again, he comes right back in the body and he's a very disturbed child. Or someone's bombed in a blast, you know, and it's just a terrible shock to the whole and everything. He'd come back in birth and he might be a retarded child. His mentality is still shocked, still in a state of shock.
Yeah. You were talking about drugs a while ago, and I have a question about modern medicine. Someone I know committed suicide about 2 weeks ago, but it took them a week to die. And what happened is they went into a coma and they were put on a respirator until their brain ceased to function. I was wondering about the karma of the people involved in this, making the decision to cut off the machine.
Oh, that's the thing
that
really...
The doctor, the people involved. Mm-hmm. Did Bob ever say anything about anything like that?
No, except we all wonder now about that. See, medicine has gone so far that you can actually keep the body alive when the brain is damaged, right? And you're in a coma and all that. Also, they heavily sedate people and stuff. And the ethical question is, when has death really occurred? Well, technically death only occurs when the sanskaras have quit and the cord is broken, the astral cord or whatever you call it, which in the Bible is called the golden cord, you know. The golden bowl is broken and the silver cord is torn or something, which means the link. Like when you astral travel, you have this cord. It's like an extension cord on a telephone. And when that's cut, you're dead. And people in a coma, the cord is not cut yet. See, whether the machine is keeping it alive or whatever. The soul can be really already experiencing the other side. And I know a boy, a Baba lover, who was very severely injured in a cycle accident. God help these cycle drivers. And he was in a coma. He was in a complete body cast. This happened to him in Hawaii, and he was shipped. It was in the Navy or something, shipped back here. But they put the wrong tag on him, you know, like a postal box package that got lost. He was shipped here and there was nobody waiting for him, and he was shipped there. And, you know, it took him a long time for the father to catch up with where the body was being shipped around one place. And what was he experiencing was that he was out of the body and was experiencing the semi-subtle while he was in a coma, and then he'd suddenly be jerked back into this full body cast and this plane and all the pain and everything, and then he'd go out again. You know, he was experiencing what people do in a state of coma. They're wandering around experiencing a semi-subtle, although you can be totally blanked out and not experiencing it at all. And when a lot of people that have had a death, shock death, the people on the other side, the so-called doctors on the other side, by the force of their mind, put the person to sleep. They put them in a deep, dreamless sleep to rest them from the shock of a bad accident, death, or, you know, something like that. Yeah.
What about, you know,
when a person's been in a coma for 6 months and you pull the plug, you know,
yeah, that's what I wanted to know. What happens?
Yeah. You know, what about the person who's ill?
Well, then that cuts the cord. You see, they're no longer attached to the body. Right. Yeah.
And that's not, I mean, that's okay to make that?
I can't say about the ethics of it, but I think I can just imagine that the sanskaras are keep, you know, the force of sanskaras is what decides your moment of death. Not the doctors, not the plugs, you know, even if the doctor, the family decides.
Well, what about the sanskaras of the doctor and the people who decided to pull the plug?
Oh, well, you're getting really hairy. I don't know. I would not like to pull a plug on anybody else. Although it seems in certain cases that it really should be done. But at this strange case of Kathy Quinlan,
yeah,
they took her off the machines and she's still alive.
She's still alive?
Yeah.
Yeah, she's still alive. So you don't know. Yeah.
Would you like to be the person that was putting the plug in, though? I mean, there's, you're assuming some kind of responsibility.
Well, it's your karma to pull the plug or put the plug in, too.
Yeah. You see, the doctors now, that's why I say they all ought to, and they will probably get to the point of understanding karma better through Baba's manifestation of his teaching. So they will probably not desperately struggle to just keep that body alive. Death is a normal thing, you know, and they'll probably get to a better point about it. Yeah.
Can I change the subject?
Yeah.
Back to your distinctions between psychic and mystical. I
yeah.
run into this problem when I try to read William Blake. I get into arguments with people, whether he's a mystical poet or a occult poet or psychic poet. How do you read Blake?
Well, Blake is really a big question. It's very hard to, in any literary work, to distinguish the state of consciousness the person was in. He was very influenced by many mystical visions he had. He was, to me, a visionary, a person whose mind, and I have a tiny bit of that myself, the mind uses symbols a great deal to teach itself things. You know, you study Jung, myth and symbol. He had a mind that could very easily manifest his own higher wisdom in the sense of symbols. And they were very dramatic to him. A lot of artists have that type of mind. And through his poetry and his art, you get a tremendous blast because you feel that his soul could express in this symbolic language so well. Now what his actual state was, who knows?
What is he expressing? Is it the psychic world or is it the mystical spiritual world?
He's expressing ideas like any poet does. The theme, he illustrated many parts of the Bible and then his own poetry, sort of like Revelations. And he's very influenced by the book of Revelations, you know. And he's trying to seek an understanding of life through symbols, and of course through his background and the era that he lived in. And I'm sure from the life of Blake he had some real genuine mystical insight and experiences, which he struggles, like many artists, to then bring down into the world of manifestation through symbology, because that's the universal language beyond words, really. The symbols are universal, you know. These archaeologists and anthropologists find all over the world in every race basic symbols. And this is what Jung made his life work, and still so much to be explored. And an artist, a creative artist, uses that consciously or unconsciously and makes, you know, communicates so much that way. A lot of Blake is just indecipherable, though. People struggle for centuries to try to find out what he really meant. And maybe he doesn't know. It's like St. John's Revelations. Has anybody ever figured that book out? 2,000 years. I always feel he had, must have had a little LSD or something. Yeah. It's really interesting. And there's a borderline, you know, between the psychic and the mystical, because you're opening up your past the rational mind. And I think you should study both God Speaks and some of the material I published in The Awakener on the early teachings of Baba. He gives the levels of the mind, you know, inspiration, lower inspiration, higher inspiration, illumination, higher, you know, he goes through the types of mind that you use. And I think an artist is certainly not using just the rational mind anymore. He's touching beyond that. to the intuitive mind's the next step. And Baba said in this age that the whole transformation of man, like at the time of Jesus, was from the age of instinct to reason, and now we're moving from reason to intuition. That's the next level. And maybe thousands and thousands of years from now we'll move from intuition to illumination, you know, or, you know, going up the scale of as a group, as a mankind, as a, and of course there are always people who are ahead of the mass, you know, like we are ahead, and they're more ahead of us, and so on. It's a pyramid. The spiritual world is really a pyramid. Yeah.
There's a fine line between psychic and intuition.
That's true, because, and nobody can say for another person where they're at. You just have to be terribly discriminating about your own experiences. And I think that's the only keynote, which the Buddha said at the beginning of wisdom is to know how ignorant you are. And I think that's true of psychic phenomena. But as you grow with Baba, as your guide, he guides you through these this flowering of your intuition. Yeah. Time to go? Oh, okay, great. Jai Baba, thank you.